You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial stations from coast to coast on Dial Global, on non-commercial stations via Pacifica Network, all across North America, Europe, and Africa, and broadcasting all over the all over North America on Free Speech TV, on DirecTV, and Dish Network. Welcome to our program. We're doing our show live today from the Health Action 2010 conference being put on by Families USA. It'll be today and tomorrow. And it's a lot going on, but first of all, just a funny, I want to get this out of the way. I got this note from Joe in Minneapolis. He says, the only real mistake that was made by that cruise line captain was that he was in the wrong industry. He says, if he had been at the helm of a Wall Street bank and caused a calamity of the same proportions, he would have gotten a $100 million bonus, and or maybe if he'd been Mitt Romney. So anyhow, the thought for the day. But the news for the day, there's a bunch of stuff in the news right now. Rick Perry's dropping out, and he's throwing in an endorsement to Newt Gingrich. Meanwhile, Newt Gingrich's second wife, Marianne, has done an interview, which is going to be on ABC News tonight, and they've released parts of the content of that interview, saying that while he was married to her and having an affair with Calista, his current wife, and presumably this was about the time that he was prosecuting Bill Clinton for having sex in the White House, that he came to her and didn't just say, I want a divorce. He came to her and said, I want an open marriage. And this is the kind of thing that's really, you know, kind of anathema, I would think, to the religious right and the family values folks. And so the question in my mind is, when a news service like ABC, for example, a reporting agency or reporters have a story of that kind of potency that is he said, she said. I mean, this is very – Newt could come out and deny this. He could say something else. Should they – and there's an election 2 days later. Is this the kind of story that they should sit on? Is this the kind of story that they should release? What's their obligation? With me, joining me now, and I'm so pleased to have her on the program, Eleanor Cliff, contributing editor to Newsweek and thedailybeast.com, and a longtime reporter in many, many venues, and I have so much respect for your insight into these issues. Eleanor, welcome. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
And I'm curious, what your thoughts are. You heard the setup. If you were in an editorial meeting at ABC News and they were debating this, what would the conversation most likely be like?
Well, I think they're going ahead and putting it out in a prime news format tonight, and evidently the juiciest tidbit has been leaked. I actually have read that before. That's kind of old news, if you will.
She told Esquire magazine that in 2010.
Yeah, I think everybody covering Gingrich was wondering when the unhappy second wife was going to step forward.
Right.
And she was a likely person for reporters to pursue, and which they did. And she basically has repeated a story that she's told in the past. I think it hurts Gingrich. I don't know that it's enough to, you know, damage him and stop the surge as an alternative to Romney, because he is running now in a state where they really care about values. But he's had enough negative stuff out there about his personal life. If that were the concern, I don't know that this is going to change things significantly.
Apparently, in that 2010 interview with Esquire, what she said was that Newt said that he wanted to share her with Calista. Now she's actually using the phrase open marriage, at least from what I'm reading.
And I think he wanted, I mean, my impression is that he wanted permission to do this, as opposed to ending the marriage, which he eventually did. I covered her when they were married, and at one point, their marriage was turbulent. At one point, he gave an interview to the Washington Post where he put odds on the marriage surviving, and they were roughly 50-50. And I think, you know, his dalliances and his unreliability as a husband is probably not news to her. And my late husband and I wrote a book called War Without Bloodshed, The Art of Politics. We had a chapter on Newt Gingrich. And part of it went into their marriage a little. And people around them said that they acted like teenagers sometimes. They would go off watch lots of movies and eat popcorn, and you know, she would call him Nudie, and he would call her Ginthy, I think, her. and they didn't seem really grown up in their relationship. But whoever Nude is with, he promotes as the smartest person in the world. And he is doing that now with Callista. She's involved in everything. Right. And he did that with Ginther, was Mary Ann's last name, Ginther, which is why he called her Ginthy. And she co-edited a book with him, and she was at his side all the time. But she was not comfortable in that role. And I remember she fled from a press conference once in tears when, remember, this is a number of years ago, and the press was questioning whether she was really just a glorified secretary or whether she played a legitimate role in co-editing the book, and their finances came under scrutiny. So there's a lot of history there. You know, disgruntled wife, and I'm sure she has, she's justified in a lot of her feelings.
Yeah. I'm curious how a party that so aggressively, sanctimoniously almost, mm-hmm. not even almost, prosecuted Bill Clinton, I mean, to a person, you couldn't find a Republican who, there were a few who said this is over the top, but by and large, everybody was in lockstep. If he's going to lie to his wife, he'll lie to America.
Right, right.
How that same party can serious, and they've gotten even more hard right than they were then,
right.
How that same party can be seriously considering Newt Gingrich, given this past, as an alternative to Mitt Romney. Isn't that not so much a commentary on Newt Gingrich as it is on Mitt Romney?
Well, it's a definition of conservatism. If you're the kind of conservative who worries that Romney's going to go back on his pledge to be opposed to abortion, and you're suspicious of him then, you can look at Gingrich and figure he'd be steadfast. He led the conservative movement. There are some things about Gingrich that you can trust. If you're the kind of conservative who really looks at the personal life of the person, then you should love Mitt Romney because he's got an impeccable personal life. And
other than his dog.
Well, I guess. And Gingrich, you know, doesn't. So I'm sure this is creating a lot of angst for voters in South Carolina. And then they've got Rick Santorum, who, of course, lines up perfectly with all the personal values, and yet they're worried about his electability. And
right, but it turns out he just won Iowa.
I know, right, and Newt is going after Romney, not so much on his personal finances, but on the fact that the impact they might have on his electability. So now it's all about who's the best of these two or three flawed candidates to beat Obama.
Yeah, it's kind of... I'm trying to come up with a metaphor that doesn't denigrate somebody, and I can't. But you know,
right.
maybe frogs in ponds or something. But you know,
right.
what a
struggle!
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whose
yeah.
flaws are worse than whose?
Right. It's a tough one. But just in the last minute that we have here, just to the news end of this, do you think that a news agency, if they, let's say this was a new bombshell, should they wait until after the election, or should they release it the moment that they have it?
Oh, I think they should release the moment they have it. This isn't some secret source. This is a person I'm sure not a lot of news outlets have tried to get to.
Right.
And, you know, putting it out there is, you know, it's fair game. But you need to have some context. The fact that she's told this story before.
Right.
And I don't know that Newt Gingrich is going to directly respond. If I were him, I would just ignore it, frankly.
Yeah. Or say it. This is old news.
Yeah, this is old news, and I'm not perfect, and now, but I'm a 67-year-old, 68-year-old grandfather, and look at the totality of my life, and look at my happy marriage now. That's probably what he's going to do.
And he's got those talking points down.
Eleanor
Clift, Newsweek, and DailyBeast.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely.
It's an honor. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with more here from the Tom Hartman Program from Health Action 2012. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Health Action 2012, Families USA's conference, annual conference on what's going on with the healthcare system in this country, which we will be getting into as we go through the day. But the there's a bunch of things that I think are big news. President Obama yesterday saying no to the XL pipeline. And the high wire act that the Republicans played, thinking that they could back him into a corner on this. I mean, they set this up so that he had to, within about a month, he had to make a decision on the XL pipeline. And they wanted to do that early in the election season so they could beat him up with it for a whole year or for most of the election year. And they were, like, you know, rubbing their hands in glee on this thing. And I think they just shot themselves in the foot. And it's just amazing how the Republicans basically, you know, they killed this oil pipeline project, and you know, what did it mean and where did it go? But anyhow, we're at the Health Action 2012 Families USA here in Washington D.C. at the Hyatt Regency, and with me is Dr. Janet Woodcock. You are the director of the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research with the Food and Drug Administration. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for joining us today. It helps if I open your microphone. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. There's a couple talking about how Tylenol, contaminated Tylenol, killed their child. And apparently there was this shadow recall where Johnson & Johnson went out and bought things back but didn't announce a recall. But nobody really knows for sure. What's the FDA doing on that, and is that the kind of thing that you're involved in? And you know, that seems to be like the big FDA story of the day, if there is a story of the day for the FDA. And then beyond that, I'm curious, you know, why are you here, and what's up with the FDA and the health services going forward?
Well, absolutely. FDA, and the part of FDA that I head, the drug center, is in charge of overseeing the quality of drugs that are marketed. So we don't only approve drugs, we make sure that their manufacturing remains adequate and up to standard during the entire time the drug is on the market.
Right.
So we certainly, FDA inspects these firms and tries to make sure that the manufacturing is up to par.
Do you know anything about this J&J Tylenol thing?
Well, certainly we have been involved in the recall and the whole action around this, but I couldn't comment on the particular case you raised.
Not your detailed area. So your thoughts on the state of health care in the United States. I mean, here we are at the Health Action 2012 conference. As the director for the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research at the FDA, your thoughts on what's going on?
Well, I mean, healthcare is kind of it's the best of all times and the worst of all times. We have tremendous scientific advances now, and they have so much promise to help our patients. But of course, the question is, can we afford them, and can they be applied properly to help people's health and not cause harm? So it's really a very challenging time, I believe.
What's being done to meet those challenges?
Well, from the drug side at FDA, we're both in charge of making sure that innovative medicines get to patients in a timely manner, that people have access to lower-cost generics where it's legal to make those available, but also that the safety of the products remains after they're on the market and that the benefits to the public outweigh the inherent risks of the drugs.
Right.
So it's a big job.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And you get a lot of flack. I know that people... I'm not even sure this is a right-left issue, although it seems more like the right-wingers on shortwave radio kind of thing. You know, think of you as the Gestapo who's going to come take them away, or maybe the promoters of Laetrile or something. But the process, you know, one of the big hits from the right on government bureaucracy is that, you know, it takes too long for life-saving drugs to get to market because of all these regulations and rules. Does it take too long? Or, on the other hand, you know, we've seen Vioxx, I think it was, and we've seen a few other drugs where there's, like, some pretty aggressive recalling going on and lawsuits and whatnot. There's now the medication that was for diabetes appears to be causing bladder cancer, if the TV ads from the lawyers are right. Are we hitting a happy medium and there's a few oops, or are we going too fast or too slow?
Well, I think it's actually more complicated like that, or as many things are when you look closely at them. All right. First of all, the reason drug regulation was put into place was a huge series of tragedies over the years where people were poisoned or killed in large numbers of people because of drugs that weren't tested for safety or they were contaminated or and so on. So there's that side of the question.
Right.
Then there's the other side. It does take a long time to gather the evidence that a drug works. And
right.
during drug development, say for cancer drug, that would be a life-saving drug potentially, 9 out of 10 cancer drugs that are tested in people don't make it.
They don't.
Because they either don't work or because they aren't safe enough. They are so toxic that
the side effects are worse than the...
That's exactly right. And so you might say, well, that's the FDA's fault. But in general, we understand that's what the patients want.
In the 40 seconds or so we have left, to what extent do the drug companies pay for that kind of work, and to what extent does the government pay for it? Are we subsidizing the drug industry?
The drug industry pays for about 60% of that work, which primarily is reviewing their applications and overseeing their clinical trials and so forth. They do pay substantial user fees for the FDA to do that.
Do they have control over that process, or do you?
Not a bit. We have control over it.
That's reassuring.
Yeah.
That's very reassuring. Thank you so much, Dr. Janet Woodcock, the director of the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research at the Food and Drug Administration. Thanks so much for dropping by today. Just in a word or two, we're moving in the right direction?
I believe so, but it's going to be a big challenge.
It is. It seems like, you know, whether it's pharmaceuticals or whether it's delivering pharmaceuticals or anything else in our healthcare system, there's just all this heat and not so much light around it. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back on the Tom Hartman Program, live from Health Action USA here at the Hyatt in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more of your calls and thoughts and more of the news of the day right after this. Stick around here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Be your love.
Welcome back. Well, this is the big question for the Republicans right now. I don't think they love anybody, and it's going to be an interesting year. And I think we'll just leave it at that. Right now, as Perry endorses Newt, this overthink progress. Will Newt disavow his endorsement of Perry's claim that Social Security is unconstitutional? That's very interesting. And despite, you know, publicly backing one person marriage forever and I will support family values, etc., Newt Gingrich, the big mainstream media news of the day, maybe news, maybe not, is that within his second marriage, when he was having an affair with his current wife, but he was married to his second wife and living with her, Newt Gingrich asked her if she would have an open marriage. Yeah. So, to me, it's like watching the circus. Don't know how to say it beyond that. Jeff in Mechanicsville, Maryland. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Jeff.
I'm calling for my mother, and she's 93. She's seen many political things go by in her life. She's frustrated by the lobbyists controlling, having so much power and money. But her question, specifically now, is this man has his money in
this man mean
Cayman bank account.
Mitt Romney.
And he's Mitt Romney is avoiding the taxes on his money. Her question was this, is there's a 10% tithe expected by the Mormon Church. Is he trying to avoid that also? And if he is, what would be the Mormon response to that, officially and unofficially?
Well, that's a good question. Let me answer the second part first. I don't know what the response of the Mormon Church would be to somebody not tithing, although I think that it's far more aggressive and mandatory in that church than in most. But one of the things that has come out of the analysis of Bain that people are looking at is that the Mormon Church was given big chunks of stock in some of the deals that Romney put together that were the most lucrative. And so millions, perhaps tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions, who knows, but certainly millions of dollars in stock and in dividends and other, you know, assets value has been given to the Mormon Church by Bain Financial. And I'm assuming that that's Mitt's tithe. And then he personally has, you know, tithes to the Mormon Church. And that's the reason why, even though he has, you know, over $300,000 in income that's theoretically taxable at a 35% rate, and then in addition to that, he has millions that's taxable at a maximum 15% rate, he's still apparently only paying around 15%, because what is dragging that down is he's probably tithing an amount equal to what he, you know, what he's making in his speaker's fees, a couple $100,000 a year, as 10% of a couple $1 million a year. So he's probably backing out all of his ordinary income and as tithes to make it completely tax deductible, and then just paying the 15% income tax on his investment income, on his capitalist gain in income. Did I answer her questions?
Well, so yes, but it raises another question. So these Republicans have bought the country through corporations and lobbyists. Now, does this mean that he's bought the Mormon Church through Bain Capital's gifts to the church?
I don't know. You know,
like it would be a tremendous bias.
Yeah,
toward him.
Well, the Mormon Church, arguably, I mean, the reports that we heard at the time when Prop 5 was being debated in California, which undid the gay marriage law in California, was that the Mormon Church was funding as much as half of the entire effort. Between actual cash donations and sending volunteers and, you know, setting up phone banks in Utah and having volunteers from all over the country go to California. So, you know, to the extent to which the Mormon Church is going, and Mormons, people within the church, are going to be intentionally mobilized or simply naturally mobilized as a natural constituency on behalf of Mitt Romney is unknown and probably unmeasurable. Whether, you know, the ability of an individual, a very wealthy individual, to buy influence in the church, to have some influence over the board of governors or whatever they call the thing, that I think they're called elders, the board of elders or whatever it is with the Mormon Church,
right.
And who decides who the current prophet is, who the head prophet is, or the head guy in the church. I frankly don't know enough about the Mormon Church to know whether, you know, it would seem that he would probably have some mojo there in his own church, particularly if he's giving them millions and millions of dollars. But I don't know, and so Jeff, thanks a lot for the call and you know, much appreciated. Let's see here, Dave in Wilmington, Ohio. Hey, Dave, you had a pipeline spill?
Yes, we had an 8-inch line break in Wilmington here.
This is an oil pipeline?
It is a petroleum. Yeah, it's already refined. It's gasoline.
Uh huh.
And they're saying that it's one of the worst Ohio natural environmental disasters in Ohio.
Wow.
It's pretty much been kept quiet because, you know, we're just a little village out in nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And
is it contaminating water supplies or?
There are ditch lines running near it. It looks like it's. It could head to the Black River and head to Lake Erie, but unsure.
Wow, amazing. Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I was going to say they say it's contained, but
You know, on the existing Keystone Pipeline that is currently carrying tar sands oil from Canada down to Missouri and then east over to Indiana where it's being refined into gasoline and whatnot, that pipeline had, I believe, 11 spills in the last year. So, you know, if your point is, and I'm guessing, you know, hey, look out, pipelines can be dangerous, it's not getting anywhere near enough publicity, those kinds of things. And thank you for pointing it out, Dave. Thanks for the call and for the heads up. I appreciate it. And thanks for being with us on the program. Dick in Kirkland, Washington. Dick, listening to AM Talk 1090. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I suggest the story about Newt Gingrich's ex-wife would be an advantage to him.
Because
it would take votes away from Mitt Romney in Utah, the polygamists and all that. That's an open marriage thing.
I don't think most modern Mormons are into polygamy. No, they're not.
It's a kind of tongue in cheek.
Okay.
But, all
right. He'll get the adulterer vote, and you know the studies show that you know, in married couples, something like 60% of all men have had an affair and 40% of all women, roughly. I mean, the numbers are in those neighborhoods. So if he got the adulterer vote, that would be pretty amazing.
This is a big story for Newt.
There you go. Okay, thanks a lot, Dick. Appreciate the call. Douglas in Hayward, Wisconsin. Hey, Douglas, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You truly are a great American.
Oh, thank you.
I could talk about the strip mining bill they're trying to push through the Wisconsin legislature. I could talk about our Department of Revenue scheme to put detailed information about the insides of people's houses on the Internet. But I'm calling today to talk about Mitt Romney's tax, his exorbitant tax rates.
Right, the horrible 15% he pays.
Right. I'm self-employed, and in a good year, I make between $40,000 and $50,000 from by my sweat and effort.
Yeah.
And I pay a net of 14.12% of that income just in Social Security and Medicare taxes, the self-employment tax.
Right.
I'm considered the employer and the employee.
Yeah, been there, done that.
And then I pay my regular income tax rates on what's left after that.
Yep.
These folks with all their capital gains and unearned income, they don't pay any Social Security tax or Medicare tax on that income at all.
You're right.
It's no wonder that 1% of the country that controls 50% of the wealth only pays 37% of the taxes. They're not paying their fair share.
Yeah.
And thank you, Tom, for everything you do for all of us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Douglas, and thanks for keeping on top of it and for everything you're doing. You know, it's much appreciated. It's really quite remarkable. John in how do you pronounce that town in Tennessee there, John, where you are calling from?
Unicoi.
Okay, that's what it looked like. But so what's up?
I really just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on the government, because to me it seems like the government's exactly where it was in England when we ceded, you know, unfair taxation without proper representation, and it seems like the founding fathers would have put something in this in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that, you know, kind of prevented the government from becoming exactly what it was.
I agree. And in fact, this was a large, if you go back and you read the debates in the Constitutional Convention, this was a large point of debate and contention. Not so much contention, concern. How do we prevent the aristoi, was how Thomas Jefferson referred to them, the aristocrats, the very, very wealthy, or future very, very well. How do we prevent them from basically taking over the government and converting the commons, converting the country, to their own benefit, and you know, reef jiggering the laws. And one of the ways that they came up with is to put some to keep power as close to the people as possible, and it was put all the taxing and spending authority with the House of Representatives, which is elected every 2 years, number one. And then number two, in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, allow Congress to actually define what the Supreme Court can and cannot rule on. And unfortunately, Congress has never used that power, and I think they should. John, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Right to the heart of the issue.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're broadcasting live. You can hear all the noise in the background. We're broadcasting live from the Radio Row at Health Action 2012 at the Families USA Conference. Back with more. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from the Health Action 2012 Families USA Conference. And picking up some of your thoughts on this whole bizarre rule by the 1% that is so well exemplified in the life and times of Mitt Romney. Joe in Forest Lake, Minnesota. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's kind of a meme thing, and we keep referring to the capitalist gains, the carried interest, and all this stuff is just capital gains, but I think we should refer to it the way the IRS does and call it unearned income.
Yeah, that is the technical term for it.
It is unearned income. They didn't earn any of it.
Right, and therefore they should get the bonus of only paying a maximum 15% tax on it.
Yeah, exactly. It makes absolutely no sense.
Bizarre.
And I think if we keep hammering that it is unearned,
yes,
as opposed to wages, it rebounds better than capital gains.
Yeah,
unearned.
I think you're right, and I'll start using that phrase more often because you're right. That is exactly how the IRS refers to it, is as unearned income. That's the tax category.
The Republicans have been pounding us on phrasing. Let's hit them back.
Yeah, there you go. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Jonathan in Hadley, Mass. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hello, Tom. My question to you is, do you think at this point that perhaps Mitt Romney doesn't look like the clear Republican candidate simply because he seems to be the antithesis of the Occupy movement and the 99%? He is the 1%. Do you think it's an accident that Newt Gingrich is all of a sudden going to make a push and that the other Republicans might align with Gingrich as things go forward?
The weird thing is that Romney doesn't have a majority. I mean, he's pulling in the 30s, right? And just behind him is Gingrich, and just behind Gingrich is Santorum. If Santorum pulled out of the race and just left Gingrich, or vice versa, if Gingrich pulled out of the race and just left Santorum, Rick Perry pulled out earlier today and threw his endorsement to Newt Gingrich. But if either one of those two guys pulled out of the race, then Mitt Romney would most likely lose, and one of those two guys would end up the Republican nominee, because most people just don't like Mitt Romney. He's not likable, even though they think he's electable, which doesn't make any sense to me. But the problem is that Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum both have such outsized egos that they're willing to take the ship down, and Romney's gonna end up, you know, with the election by default. And in my opinion, I don't think Gingrich. We'll see, you know, but I don't think that at the end of the day, I think the Republican. I mean, here's the thing that tells me this. When the Iowa primaries were held, it turns out that Rick Santorum actually won, and won by far more than the 8 votes that they said that Romney won by. But the Republican establishment put out that Romney won and waited a couple of weeks to say oops, so that Romney could run around saying, hey, I'm the first non-incumbent ever in history to win both Iowa and New Hampshire. And that says to me that the Republican establishment, the machine, has already decided on Romney, and they're very, you know, concerned about and don't like these other candidates. And the Republican Party is so hierarchical and so rigidified, and the machine is so wealthy and so powerful, and Mitt is wealth and power. I mean, they're synonymous.
Don't you think it's more likely, though, that, for instance, Newt Gingrich's marital problems will sort of disappear, but Romney's history as a capitalist isn't going to disappear? As a matter of fact, it's going to become more and more prominent.
No, in fact, and what the Republicans are going to do is they're going to double down. They're going to do what they've always done. This is what Thomas Frank wrote about in What's the Matter with Kansas, is they're going to say, yeah, we're the party of rich guys, but we want everybody to be rich. We want everybody in America to have that kind of opportunity. We think everybody in America should make $5, $10, $30 million. And, you know, give us the reins of government, we'll make sure it happens. Which, of course, is utter nonsense. They're the party of the 1%, keeping the 1% in power and destroying and wiping out the middle class in order to make the 1% wealthier. I mean, you know, in the last 30 years since Reaganomics came into power, the bottom 99% has seen their net, you know, income, and this is family income, wealth, go up maybe, what, 8%, 11%, somewhere in that neighborhood. The top 1%, it's over 270%. I think 272 is the number that sticks in my mind. So, but they're, you know, just watch. I may be wrong on this, but I've been watching this for a long time. They're going to double down on it. They're going to say yes, and you're going to be hearing Mitt Romney say, I'm a turnaround guy. I'm the guy who turns around companies. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes people lose their jobs, of course. That's the nature of turnarounds. But and some people are going to get hurt turning around America, but at the end of the day, things are going to be better. That's going to be his sales pitch. And you're going to hear that echoed on all the right-wing shows, and you're going to hear him saying that on the stump over and over and over again. And until it's just like, you know, blinding in our eyes. I mean, it's just amazing. Amazing. Mary in Bourne, Texas. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. you know, I back the 99%ers all the way, but what they've done, it has not changed any of the way the government acts or any of the way Wall Street acts. Once in a while, they get them annoyed enough to send their little police force out and occasionally put a little strong arm in there, but nonviolence is not going to change the way the 1%ers operate. They're too strong.
Mary, to some extent what you're saying is true, but it was also true of the early abolition protests. It was also true of the early women's rights protests. It was also true of the early civil rights protests.
That was smaller. Country.
No, but where I was going with that thought is that up until the Occupy movement 3 months ago, a couple of days ago, burst onto the scene, the debate in America being held by both Democrats and Republicans was, what are we going to do about this big deficit? And implying that the deficit and the debt were Barack Obama's fault when in fact they were run up by three Republican presidents and Reaganomics. We haven't heard much discussion about that since then. It's been all about inequality in the United States. And that, even though it hasn't yet led to any significant legislation, and it won't until the composition of Congress changes, I think that's a really, really, really big deal that we're having that conversation in America, in the corporate media, in the mainstream media, and the politicians are being forced to confront it. So I think it's a step in the right direction. Thank you, Mary.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from the Health Action 2012 Families USA Conference. Trying to have a little lunch during my news break there. God, welcome back. I want to get back into some of these. This is an interesting question. John in Minneapolis, I think you have a fascinating question. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I support, my local congressman, Keith Ellison, and he is a member of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But I'm really, really getting tired when I hear stories like Senator Patrick Leahy supporting and going against the will of the people in this SOPA, bill.
Right.
And I feel that, why should I support the Democratic Party? I voted Democrat since 1974. I've been a loyal member. And I think either, the Occupy movement is going to join with the progressives and just, swamp the Democratic Party, or we need to have a third party. Every other country in the world has a third party. It's a sign of democracy, a substantial third party.
Yeah. John, a couple of points, if I may.
Yes.
First of all, are you familiar with the distinction between first-past-the-post, winner-take-all democracies and proportional representation democracies?
Well, I know a little bit about it, and I know that we have, a winner-take-all system.
Right.
And I think that I would like to see that changed. I would like proportional representation.
Right.
Sure, why not? Who would be against?
That would require, rewriting the Constitution to do that.
Which isn't
going to happen next week.
Maybe it needs to happen. Maybe that is what the focus.
But, to open the Constitution to a constitutional convention right now to let people tinker with it when most of our politicians, so many of our politicians, are owned basically by the Koch brothers or other industries.
Well, I think it would be a devastating thing. A very, very strong grassroots swamping of the Democratic Party and a takeover of the Democratic Party would, you know, would...
Now you're singing my song. Because this is... You started out by saying... Why should I support the Democratic Party? And I almost interrupted
John, let me get a thought out here,
okay? I almost interrupted you at that point. I wanted to let you, though, get through your whole rant. I almost interrupted you and said, you shouldn't just blindly support the Democratic Party. You should infiltrate it, take it over, and remake it in the nature that you think it should be. That, you know, our obligation as citizens is not just to vote, and it's not just to sit around and complain. If we are concerned about our democracy, if we're concerned, or our republic, you know, if you want to use the term that Republicans prefer we all use, if you're concerned about the future of the country, well, you need to get involved. And that doesn't necessarily mean running for office, but certainly getting, you know, I mean, it's like if you wanted to take over, Bain Capital, you'd have to be a multimillionaire, multi-hundred millionaire like Mitt Romney. But if you want to take over the Democratic Party, all you got to have is enough people.
That's right, yes.
And so, you know, because we don't have proportional representation in the United States, and we're one of five democracies out of 112 democracies in the world, there's only five that don't have proportional representation. And it's us, Canada, England, Greece, six, Australia, and New Zealand. And Australia and New Zealand, what they've done is they've gone to instant runoff voting, or their own local variation on that, which produces the same effect. It allows for third and fourth and fifth parties to involve themselves.
Can I interrupt? In Canada, they have a parliamentary system, and I understand that they do have three parties. They have significant representation within the national government.
They do.
You know, different types of parties, and we don't.
Yes and no. They have basically two very strong parties, and then they have a bunch of minor parties. In Canada, you vote for the individual, not for the party. So it's not true proportional representation. In a proportional representation system, you vote for the party, and the party pretty much tells you who their candidate's going to be. You know who the candidate is, but you vote for the party, and then the parties are assigned seats in parliament or the legislature based on their percentage of the vote. And it's not quite how it works in Canada. In Canada, you vote for the individuals who run on party platforms. And you've also got the weirdnesses of things like, you know, Quebec and the old secessionist movement and the Quebecois. And it's, you know, Canada has its own problems politically, and as any Canadian will tell.
I know it does. Yeah, it also has a Labour Party that has significantly, had many inroads into that democracy.
Yep.
And, I don't see...
And we did it one time.
We did at one time, but that's not good enough. We need it desperately now.
I agree with you.
I do see that the Occupy movement, that has made me feel more optimistic that there are people that do see the light and are, you know, really engaging the system. But we can't just, you know, we have to move forward. And moving forward, I think we need to really, really, you know, slam the Democratic Party and change it.
Slam into them, become them, take them over. Yes,
right.
Absolutely. The problem with starting a third party, as appealing as it sounds, and in fact, Louise and I had dinner last night with Ben Mansky, who is the campaign manager for the Green Party's presidential candidate, Jill Stein, I get the Green Party, and I love their platform.
No.
But the problem with a third party is that infrastructure is incredibly expensive for a political party in the United States. You've got to have offices,
right.
You've got to have people, you've got to have phone lines, you've got to have buildings, you've got to have all this stuff.
Right.
And there's literally hundreds of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure that the Democratic Party owns, and it's not like anybody owns it other than the party, and the party is made up of whoever shows up. And
right.
the same is true of the Republican Party, by the way. And the Tea Partiers showed up, and they took the damn thing over. And John Boehner's out there wringing his hands, doesn't know what to do. And we need to be doing the same thing with the Democratic Party. John, I got to move along, but you made your point really, really well, and I think that we have a lot of areas of agreement here. And the one thing, just to bring it back to the Occupy movement, that I found really encouraging was that, and we covered this on the show yesterday, that the day before yesterday when it was Occupy Congress, that a lot of the Occupy folks, some of them were like protesting Congress and protesting the broken system and you know, get money out of the system, kind of more big picture generic concepts. But a lot of people were actually going to talk to their member of Congress about specific issues, like, hey, move to amend.org. We need to get money out of politics and you know, say that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. And in fact, you know, Ben Mansky is one of the big leaders in that. Also, great guy. He was on our TV show last night. Also, Onita in Sanford, Maine. Do I have that right?
And am I correct? Correct.
Okay. What's up?
I have a question I have no answer to and cannot find an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I learned in the last debate, the Republican debate, that George Romney, Mitt's dad, was born in Mexico.
That's right.
So that means he is not a naturalized, he's not a citizen of the United States.
George Romney was not a natural-born citizen. Mitt is.
Then how can he run for president?
Well, because George isn't running for president. Mitt is.
No, he did run for president.
Oh, well.
He did run.
Yeah, you're right. And
how was he allowed to? How was he allowed to?
I frankly don't know. I was, you know, 10 years old when that happened, and I don't know the history of it. I have to say I don't know.
Well,
I lived in Michigan. He was the governor of our state, and a pretty reasonable governor when he came back from Vietnam and said he was brainwashed, even though he was a Republican. But George Romney's father and his grandfather, actually his grandfather, George Romney, Mitt Romney's great-grandfather, moved from the United States, from Utah, I believe it was, to Mexico so that he could legally have a bunch of wives. So he could have, I think, almost a dozen wives because the United States had just outlawed polygamy. And so Mitt Romney's great-grandfather, and I believe his grandfather as well, had lots and lots of wives and kids. But how George ran for president, I don't know, Anita. Sorry.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more here from Health Action 2012 Families USA Conference. Tom Harbin, live with you from Washington, D.C.
Today is the first day of the rest of our lives. Tomorrow is too late to pretend that it's all right now.
Well, it seems like all of the Republicans want to turn Social Security into a giant money pot for the folks on Wall Street, like Mitt Romney, who has all these millions stashed to the Cayman Islands. And Medicare, too, for that matter, which, you know, let's just turn it over to United Healthcare, where Stephen Hemsley has made $400 million, and his predecessor, Dollar Bill McGuire, made $1.7 billion in compensation as the CEO of a health insurance company. This is bizarre. So Max Richman is with us. He's the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He's the former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging. Max, welcome to the program. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me turn your microphone up.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's an honor. It's a pleasure to have you with us. What is the situation right now with regard to Social Security, Medicare? Where is it going? What are the battles? And why should not just people of Social Security age, but people in their 20s and 30s be concerned about this?
Well, you asked exactly the right question. Both programs have been under assault for quite a while, and the reason being there's money to be had by, as you went through the list, Wall Street titans and people in the healthcare, insurance, pharmaceutical industry. So there's a lot of money to be made. So I think what we need to do now, and what we have our organization been doing for some time, is educate people, the public, so they can separate the myth from the fact. There are so many myths about Social Security, and they've been accepted by a lot of Americans, that the program's broke, that it's bankrupt, there's no money there, and that makes
these are not true at all.
Not true at all.
Social Security Trust Fund is $2.6 trillion right now, right?
$2.6 trillion, and that's not Max Richman saying it, it's the trustees.
Right.
Growing by another trillion over the next 10 years. And then they'll, at that point in 2023 or 4, that trust fund will be used up as the baby boomers are in full force in retirement.
As was intended. I mean, that rabbit moving through the python was put there because the baby boomer demographic is the rabbit moving
through
the python.
Absolutely. It's by design. This program has to, as it has in the past, it's a dynamic program. It's gone through many adjustments in terms of benefits and revenue financing. Some modest adjustments over a long period of time will keep the program sound even beyond 2036.
So how do we deal with the fact that because of these years and years of lies and misinformation coming from mostly very wealthy people and people with a political agenda as well, that if you ask the average 20 or 30-year-old, particularly the 20-somethings, you know, what do you think of Social Security? Their answer is almost knee-jerk. It ain't going to be there when I get that age. I don't care.
Right. Well, my response, first of all, is to try to get the facts out that it will be there. And with the help of people like yourself and the media, have more of an opportunity to reach all people, younger as well as older. But then I try to explain to younger people, and this was your threshold question, Social Security is not just for seniors. It's a family program.
That's right. About a third of the total payments are for widows, orphans, and disabled people, right?
A third of the beneficiaries are non-retired workers, as you mentioned, widows, spouses, survivors, children. 4 million children get by in life because of Social Security. And when I address a group of younger people, I point those facts out. I tell them if, for example, you are a 27-year-old worker with a spouse and two children, you have right now, forget about retirement, whenever you reach eligibility for retirement benefits, you have right now almost half a million dollars in combined disability and death benefits, life insurance, disability
through
and through Social Security. Now, a lot of younger people that may be saying it won't be there when I reach retirement age, they don't even know that it's there for them right now.
Right. Now, why 27? Is that?
I just picked that.
That's just a random number. So it's also true of a 23-year-old?
Yes. I just picked a computation to throw a figure out there.
Okay.
It would vary depending on the age. But the real point is it's a family program for all ages, for survivors, children, disabled. And, you know, one way you might be helpful is in your broadcast, explain to people what FICA means.
Right.
Do you know?
I don't.
You know the term FICA?
I've known in the past, but at the moment
you've known the term FICA. Everybody knows it from their pay stubs.
Federal Insurance.
You're good. Federal Insurance Contribution Act.
Contribution Act. Thank you.
It's an insurance program. It's not just for retirement. It's an insurance program. It funds another acronym, OASDI, Old Age Survivor and Disability Programs.
Right.
So this is a program that's for families, has value to families of all ages, and the way you asked how do we get younger people enlisted, explain to them, and I hope you'll keep doing it, what the program does, how it functions, how it serves families. And I think once people understand that, they think, well, maybe we should try to do what we can
and keep it around. If you're calculating the value of that life insurance policy based on age, wouldn't it be that the younger you are, the larger the life insurance policy is, because that's the survivor benefit, that's the number of years that's going to be paid out to your spouse and children?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is a program that was very well thought out, I think, by FDR and his associates, Frances Perkins, the Department of
Labor. Oh, she's brilliant. The new biographer of her is just spectacular.
I agree. And it has been improved. I mean, we now have, since the mid-70s, a cost of living adjustment. It's not enough, but it's built in so that, at least in theory, the check keeps up with inflation. We need to improve the program, not go back to the...
Not kill it off or privatize
it. Yeah, we don't need to build a bridge to Romney's the 19th century.
There you go. Okay, Max Richmond, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so
much. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the website for that is ncpssm.org, right?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you, Max. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Health Action 2012, put on by Families USA. And sitting here with me is Congressman John Sarbanes, representing the 3rd District of Maryland. And sarbanes.house.gov, the website, Twitter at Rep. John Sarbanes. Glad to have you with us, sir.
Thanks very much, Tom, for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Interesting headlines here. Dodd to Internet. You and your blackout can drop dead. And then you had some choice words on this issue. What thoughts on SOPA?
Well, it's problematic in its current form. I think people are beginning to recognize that. The sort of content side of the debate got ahead on this thing, but I think that there's real concerns about, you know, what this could mean in terms of freedom of the Internet. And so now we're having a very, very robust debate, which is what should have happened from the beginning.
Yep.
I don't think in its current form it's particularly workable, and that's being brought to people's attention, so stay tuned.
Yeah. Okay. And money, another one of your passions is money in politics. I know over the year that I've been here in Washington, D.C., I've met a number of people in politics, and at the federal level in particular, people's, like yourself, I don't know what your proportion is, but you know, some of these folks are having to spend half their days on the phone dialing for dollars when they should be legislating. And it just, you know, it opens the door up for special interest groups to write their legislation for them or for them not to really know what's going on. And we have this really messy system because of these doctrines that were created a whole cloth by the Supreme Court that money equals speech and that corporations are people and that somehow, you know, money in our political system is a healthy thing.
There's no way to overstate the influence special interests are having now on our political process. In a sense, they've taken the legislative machinery captive. There's a fellow named Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor up at Harvard, who's written a book called Republic Lost that really analyzes this issue. He estimates that the average member of Congress is now spending between 30 and 70% of their time on fundraising. He describes what he calls a dependency corruption in Washington. So it's not, you know, your Rod Blagojevich kind of quid pro quo corruption.
Right.
He says most members of Congress are decent people, but the problem is when so much of your funding comes from PACs and other special interests, you put all that together in the chamber, and it affects our ability to do our work on behalf of the public interest. And I'm determined to pursue ways of combating this. There's public financing legislation. There's a bill called the Fair Elections Now Act, which has been introduced over the last two Congresses, which basically says if a candidate can go recruit grassroots donors and build a grassroots donor network, then they get rewarded by getting access to dollars out of a public fund. And that makes sense. Unfortunately, we don't have the law in place.
Right. Except for at the presidential level.
Well, that's even being attacked now by the Republicans. But this design where you show you can recruit grassroots and then you get access to public money, we need to get that in place at the congressional level. Because let me tell you, that's where the super PACs are going to have a tremendous amount of influence.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, $5 million coming into a super PAC in South Carolina for Newt Gingrich is one thing. $500,000 coming into a congressional race somewhere in the last 3 or 4 weeks of a campaign to buy negative advertising can completely determine the outcome of that race in the final stages. So we have to push back. It will. Absolutely.
Now,
so
Congress has in, you know, again, a lot of this is the consequence, as Larry Lessig points out, a lot of this is the consequence of doctrine that has been created by the Supreme Court. Article 3, which defines the Supreme Court and the court system in the Constitution, Section 2 of Article 3, says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulations established by Congress. To the best of my knowledge, the only time Congress has ever made an effort to regulate the Supreme Court, Andrew Jackson famously told them to go screw themselves on the Cherokee issue and refused to enforce a ruling, but he didn't actually invoke the Constitution. But the only time was when FDR tried to change the composition of the regulation, the number of people on the court. So anybody over 70 didn't have a vote, basically, anymore. Congress has the power to pass a regulation that says that the Supreme Court, or at least many, many constitutional scholars suggest that Congress has the power to simply pass a law saying the Supreme Court cannot rule on issues of that have to do with quote free speech or can't rule on campaign financing issues. Why don't they?
Well, I guess there's going to be a debate as to whether Congress can do that by statute or regulation, or whether Congress has to initiate a constitutional amendment process, which
they can do. I'm a promoter of both.
Yeah, and I just came from a rally in Annapolis, in our capital city in Maryland, where legislators there are going to send a letter to Congress urging us to support a constitutional amendment to address what happened in the Citizens United case and take personhood away from corporations, which is a ridiculous status to give them. Of course, they're taking advantage of that now to get into these elections in a major way. So that is clearly one way to regulate the Supreme Court, is to tell them this is what the Constitution says or does not say. And I think the interpretation of Citizens United was so off the mark that while I generally am reluctant to pursue constitutional amendments, because that's a pretty dramatic step to take,
sure,
the stakes are so high here that I think it's worth doing. We ought to pursue it.
Yeah, we have a system now that has, as you say, is being held captive by these special interests. To what extent, it seems that if, and I've heard this from Republicans as well as Democrats, if you guys are having to spend so much of your time fundraising just to stay in office, it seems like this would, like, everybody in Congress would say, what, this is nuts, you know, let's do something about it, regardless of party. And yet it seems like it's only the Democrats who are talking about getting money out of politics, or talking about, you know, the Supreme Court was wrong when they said that money is speech, you know, backed in the Buckley case and then reaffirmed in Citizens United, or that corporations are people, First National Bank versus Bilotti, reaffirmed in Citizens United. Why has this become partisan?
It's a good question. It doesn't need to be partisan. And I think, frankly, if you step out of Congress, you can find a lot of people across the political spectrum, Republicans, Democrats, and independents, who support campaign finance reform. Americans for Campaign Reform is a very bipartisan group out there that is supporting the Fair Elections Now Act, which I just talked about. Lessig, in his book, points out how it can compromise the agenda of both parties.
It has done so
to have this much special interest influence in Congress. And the casualties of our spending this much time fundraising, the average member, is we don't get to study the material, the information, the legislation at the level we should on behalf of our constituents. We don't develop relationships with one another, which allow us to overcome the political divide to actually get good legislation through. We don't have relationships because we're spending all our time fundraising. So we've got to come up with a solution to this. I decided this campaign cycle to model the Fair Elections Now Act in my own campaign. So we went to traditional donors, and we said, we want you to create a special fund. We'll call it a challenge fund. And I'll pledge as the candidate not to touch that money till I go recruit 1,000 grassroots donors. So it's the same design as Fair Elections Now. In the absence of a public fund, we raised it privately. But I made a pledge that I'm going to go build that grassroots donor network. And if you think about it, that's the only defense you will have in the waning days of an election. If they come target you, you can't go to the traditional donors. They're maxed out by then. But you can go to the $15, $25, $50 donor and say, help me out. They're targeting me. I need you. The Internet makes it possible to bring these donations together. We put a whole program. We got a grassrootsdonor.com site where we're building this model to show how public financing would work if we could get it in place.
Is grassrootsdonor.com about the concept in abstract, or is this your campaign?
That's my campaign. That's where you can go and support this model. Mm-hmm. It's unprecedented. Nobody else is doing this right now in the country, but we want to show how this could work. And basically, it's putting the average person back in charge of the political process and saying to the special interests, the superest PAC out there is the American people, right? I mean, that's the response to the super PACs, is to put it back in the hands of the average person, promote public financing, and start to push back on what has gotten completely out of control at this point.
This didn't seem to be an issue in the Eisenhower race. You know, I mean, I was alive at the time, but I don't remember it. It certainly didn't seem to be an issue in the Kennedy race and in the Johnson race. This is something that really seems to have come about since the Reagan era. Why is that?
I think in many respects it's a combination of two things. It's a combination of the special interest becoming more bold and sort of adventurous when it comes to politics.
Right.
And starting
the Palomino.
And connecting the dots between their ability to contribute to campaigns, to hire lobbyists, to be on the Hill, and to get good results from their standpoint in terms of legislation. So you have this phenomenon where, you know, every week, Tom, legislation gets drafted in Washington that's in the public interest. By the time the special interests are done with it, by the time the lobbyists have come in and spun you around three times,
right,
it's in the private interest at that point. And you take that and you combine it with the fact, and this is interesting, the Congress now changes hands frequently from Democrats to Republicans. So every 2 years, you have a battle to regain the majority. And based on that case that you can make to your funders, you can raise huge amounts of money, and the special interests are in there driving that train. So that's changed as well. If we don't rein this in, the democracy as we know it is threatened. And I that's not hyperbole. I absolutely believe that.
Yeah, I absolutely believe you're right. Congressman John Sarbanes, sarbanes.house.gov, and
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the website for your campaign?
Is www.grassrootsdonor.com.
I think this is so great that you're doing this. Congressman Sarbanes, thank you for being
Thanks very much.
Haven't you heard the rumor?
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, live from the Families USA Health Action 2012 Conference. Here in Washington, D.C. at the Higher Regency, and sitting right across the table from me, my old friend and one of the finest reporters on earth, Ellen Ratner. And this segment, by the way, brought to you by Ellen's new book, Self-Empowerment. So, Ellen, what's up?
Okay, well, tomorrow I'll be actually in South Carolina, so you'll still be doing here, and I'll be in South Carolina.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I'll be talking to you from there.
Yeah.
And as you know, Perry has dropped off, and he endorsed Gingrich.
Yes.
Now, I don't know if you also heard that Gingrich was on television this morning, was asked about his wife's interview that I believe is going to be on, his ex-wife Marianne's interview that I believe is going to be on Nightline tonight.
Right.
I don't know if you've been talking
We've got a clip, of
so you don't need me to go through all that, but Gingrich now said that it is more important to the interest of the American people than his past life.
Yeah, he initially said he wasn't going to say anything negative about Marianne,
right,
about his second wife.
And then he's focused on the American people.
Right, and now that she's come out and said he wanted an open marriage, he's saying, well, this is old news, isn't he? I mean, because she basically told this to Esquire in 2010.
Exactly. Now, what's so amazing is, of course, these are definitely not perfect candidates. And you then have this morning the news that ABC also brought that there is money, $7 million, of Romney offshore. Now, a lot of the news is interesting. They're focusing on he's not paying taxes on that. But I think the American people don't care about the taxes as much as they do as what is a presidential candidate putting $7 million offshore for?
Yeah.
It's staggering.
Yeah.
You know, when the Swift boat ad came out, I remember seeing it. It was in the summer, and I said, he's finished. And when this came out this morning, I said, Romney's finished. How do you overcome something like that? I don't know. Okay, back to the news.
That's interesting. We'll see come November if your prognostications are. Do you think he's finished for the primary?
No, I don't think he's finished for the primary. But
for the general.
I mean, guess because of who else is running for the primary.
Yeah, I think the Republican establishment is already pretty much decided. He's their guy.
I could tell you stories, make your hair stand on end, what those guys are doing. I mean, they're already putting their people in there, and you know, they're quote unquote volunteer.
People.
Yeah. Oh, no, not Romney people. People on the Hill.
Oh, I see. The establishment Republicans.
That's right. That's right. Okay. A couple other things. The president today is in, he's at Disney in Florida. I guess it's the Disney in Florida. And yes, Disney in Florida. And there are 1.2 million jobs that are created from international travel. 2.7 of our 2.7 percent of our GDP is because of tourism. 7.5 million jobs altogether in tourism, but 1.2 due to international. And now he's issued an executive order saying that he wants they're at 80% of all applicants from Brazil and China, which are, I guess, are our two biggest feeder countries, to be interviewed within 3 weeks. You cannot get a U.S. anything. It's not like where you can pay to get something. You have to actually be interviewed. That 80% of people will be interviewed within 3 weeks, and that will be the executive order.
That's great. Those might not be our biggest feeder countries, but they're the biggest ones where you have to have a visa to get in.
Right.
So,
yes,
so
right.
We're talking about the interview
exactly.
for the visa.
Yes, yeah. Interview for visa. So Governor Mitch Daniels is going to be giving the GOP response to the State of the Union, which will be Tuesday night. Santorum has officially been declared the winner of the Iowa primary by 34 votes.
Except that the Republican Party in Iowa is still calling it a tie.
That's right. But the official, literal, whatever, because yeah. they're behind Romney.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Also, as I said, I'll be in South Carolina tomorrow. The polls are showing Romney, most of them, 10 points ahead. There is one poll that shows Gingrich ahead.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is it? It's not the Rasmussen Republican
poll?
No,
it's not one of it's like the America something or other poll, mm-hmm. and it's not a Gingrich. I mean, it's a legitimate poll.
Yeah.
And it shows Gingrich ahead.
It's going to be really interesting after ABC airs this show tonight, and it's the talk of tomorrow.
Right.
What the polls Friday night are looking like, and then the election is it Saturday or Sunday?
It's Saturday.
So they're having the debate in the morning, and then how does that work? People vote in the afternoon, or are they caucusing?
No, I think they vote all day.
But they're having the debate.
No, the debate is Tuesday. There's their debate Saturday morning. I think there's a debate Thursday night.
Oh, okay.
It's tonight.
Oh, it's that's
the
right.
The CNN debate is tonight.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And one other thing, TransCanada, according to the White House, has not identified an alternative route for their pipeline. They said it's not that they're moving slowly. They're moving as fast as they can. But the White House is obviously not going to look at anything until they have identified another route.
Right, and that's going to mean talking to a lot of property owners about we'd like to buy some of your land.
This is not an easy process, right. Fortunately.
Right. Yeah, fortunately. So what else is going on?
A couple other quick things, and that is the Department of Labor gave their statistics. 50,000 less people applied for unemployment. It's 352,000 new applications for unemployment, the lowest since 2008.
Oh, that's interesting.
Housing starts are down a little, but don't forget it is winter, et cetera, although down even for this seasonally adjusted whatever.
I understand, though, the mortgage applications are up like 30% or something.
Yes, because mortgages are also at one of their lowest ever in terms of actual cost.
You get a 30-year fixed mortgage
nowadays
for about 4%.
That's right. So now people are doing very, very well on that front. The other thing that's interesting around some of this presidential stuff is that there is a lot of talk that Florida is supposedly wrapped up for Romney, but that if Gingrich can somehow pull it out, despite the ABC stuff that's coming out, that may become fairly, if he does not win that race, that will become a little competitive.
And that's because the Florida primary, Republican primary, follows the South Carolina one.
It's the 31st.
It's the 31st of this
January.
Month, of January.
Yes,
so.
We're really, it's warp speed.
Wow.
I mean, by Super Tuesday, this will be done.
Yeah. And
some of us think it's kind of done
and super,
now.
And Super Tuesday is when?
The first Tuesday in March, I believe. Yeah.
So
we're 5 weeks?
4 or 5 weeks
away.
Away.
Yeah.
Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, brought to you by Ellen's new book, along with Ann Gaiman, personal, no, wait a minute.
Self-empowerment.
Thank you very much.
Nine things that you can learn from
the 19th century. There you go. Thank you very much, Ellen. Great to have you with us. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman with you live from Health Action 2012.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live in Washington, D.C. at the Health Action 2012 Families USA Conference. It's being held at the Hyatt. I'm on Radio Row, which means that I'm surrounded by radio talk show hosts and people having conversations, thus the background noise. My apologies for it not... It not being the normal crystal clear resonance of our show, but anyhow, there here it is, and a lot of the news. Rick Perry has this. I just find this fascinating. Does President Obama have a clear fit? You'd almost think there's no way this guy can lose the presidency, even with some of the things, you know, like signing the military authorization act, things like, even with a few things that have, you know, upset his base. I mean, he's done a fair amount of good stuff, but you look at the Republicans and you've got Richie Rich, who has millions of dollars in an offshore Cayman Islands account, versus the guy who had three wives and he tried to have an open marriage with his second one with his third one. And he's running as the family values candidate. And it boggles my mind. Newt Gingrich is now coming out and saying that he would ignore the Supreme Court. Well, actually, there may be something to that. But it's not enough to make me a Gingrich supporter. Oh, man. I'm not going on that. Anyhow, let's pick up some of your calls here. There's a lot of interesting comments here from our viewers and listeners. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Hello, yes. This is more like a post-New Hampshire primary update.
Mm-hmm.
My brother, who lives up there, just called me, told me that Mitt Romney's people are calling I guess they got a hold of the voter rolls, and they're calling all the voters in New Hampshire and thanking them for Mitt Romney's vote for Mitt Romney. And my brother said, I don't think so. He said, I'm a Democrat, and I would never vote for Republican, let alone Mitt Romney.
Yeah, this
so I don't
is
know what you're talking about. And the woman went into a tizzy. She went into a tailspin. She got all excited. But what got me was, look at the money this guy has. He's not only like leading the parade, like Sherman's march to the super primary,
right.
And he's got people behind the elephants,
yep,
cleaning up after he leaves off. Now,
I would say it goes beyond that. What those calls are doing, the reason for those calls, is to tell every single person in the state Romney won.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether they noticed it on the news or not, whether they heard it or not, whatever they heard, now this on the day that the news is coming out that Santorum actually won Iowa,
yeah,
Romney's people, and they're probably not just calling New Hampshire, they're probably also calling the people in Iowa, or actually New Hampshire, he had a victory there. So what they're trying to do is just, you know, set him up for November. I mean, this is a setup for November.
But the other thing about it is, I think my prediction is that if he wins the primary and gets elected president, the people of the United States are going to find out what the people of Massachusetts found out after 4 years. When Mitt Romney wakes up in the morning, he says, how can I make myself look good? It's all about him.
Yeah.
He's a narcissist, and to the nth extreme. You can see it in his actions, in his facial expressions, and practically everything he does. And I think it's going to be a sad day if he continues on this with unchallenged. And I just hope that the Obama people are sharpening their knives for this guy, because he deserves this.
Some of the super PACs out there, although the Obama super PACs have only about $5 million, the Romney super PACs already have $12 million. But Paul Begala is running one of those super PACs on that's not coordinated with Obama. In fact, Obama has said, please don't do this. Paul Begala went ahead and did it anyway. And they're going to be able to be, as we've seen in the race between Gingrich and Romney and Santorum and Perry so far, the super PACs come in and just say things that a candidate would never dare say for fear of being criticized for being so blunt and so awful. So it's interesting. Frank, thanks for the heads up on that and your thoughts on it. Patrick in Eastern Washington State. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a couple of questions. I'll try to get through the first one quickly.
I was wondering if you could help me understand the disconnect between corporations, the social contract, and their charters. Most of these charters, the social good and the social contract is implied. And I know California a few years ago came pretty close to revoking Exxon's charter. What are the chances for citizens getting involved in this and going after some of these charters since the government won't enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act?
It's a great question. And, you know, what most people don't know is that corporations have articles of incorporation and states have corporate charter laws that define what those articles of incorporation have to say. Those are called the charter of the corporation. And up until the 1880s and 1890s, a decade and a half roughly that's referred to by historians of the era, I write about this in my book, Unequal Protection, which is referred to as the charter-mongering era. Up until that time, every state in the union had laws that said that if a group of people want to come together and incorporate in order to get limited liability and special tax benefits and all the other benefits that you get when you incorporate, if they want to do that, the first item in their corporate charter has to state explicitly that the first and primary purpose of the corporation is to serve the public good. And it will do so by building railroad cars or making steel or whatever, which would be the second item. And when the state of Ohio, which is also where Senator Sherman was from, you know, of Sherman Antitrust Act fame, when the state of Ohio said to a few years after the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed, and I think that was 1881, when they said to John Rockefeller, which is where he was based, that Standard Oil of Ohio it was operating as an illegal trust and they were going to prosecute him, he basically just said out loud, any states out there want to change their laws? And this competition broke out on the East Coast between New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, New York, and Connecticut. Of each one trying to drop more and more, shed more and more of the onerous regulations, you know, on corporations. And Delaware won the race in that in Delaware now you can incorporate with a single sentence which says, This corporation is created to conduct any business which is legal within the state of Delaware, period, end of sentence. Whereas you used to have to specify what you did, and you had to specify that it was in the public good. Although New Jersey got John Rockefeller, because they also, you know, they won the charter mongering race for Rockefeller, but Delaware is the least restrictive, which is why more than half of all the corporations listed on the Fortune 500 are Delaware corporations. So, yeah, you're right, and most Americans don't know that, and they should know that, and waking them up to the fact that states can revoke corporate charters. I mean, that's a power that all the states still have, although the rules under which they can do so have been substantially diluted, need to be changed, and these are state level revolts. These are another good reason to get involved in state politics, and support state representatives and state senators who would take this on as an issue or get into the political process and start waking them up. Make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thanks, Tom. I didn't know about Delaware. I didn't know.
Yeah. See, and most people don't. And that's the amazing thing. And in fact, if you go to one of the LegalZoom or whatever is, you know, these relatively inexpensive, or the company corporation, I think maybe it's called the corporation company. I've actually used both of them to create corporations. This is not an endorsement. It's just, you know, they're out there. There's a bunch of companies that do this cheaply and easily. And the first corporation that they always offer is Delaware because it's the cheapest, it's the easiest. And that all is from the 1890s. And basically we need to go back to the laws that we had prior to the charter mongering era, and when thousands of corporations every year were shut down because they weren't serving the public interest. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more from Health Action 2012 here in Washington, D.C., a conference put on by Families USA. Tom Hartman here with you at the Health Action 2012 Conference, Families USA in Washington, D.C., and John in Tomahawk, Wisconsin. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I'm interested in this
I just wanted to comment on a current example of how evil these hedge funds are over on Wall Street. In our area here, we have a lot of paper mills up here in the Northwoods. Recently, a hedge fund
John, your phone is kind of garbling. If there's any chance that maybe you're putting your thumb over the microphone or something, if you could, or stand in one place, go for it again.
Okay. All right. So we're here up here in Tomahawk, Wisconsin, and we've got quite a few paper mills in our area.
Yeah.
And I want to mention an example of a hedge fund from Wall Street here, the Starboard Value LLC. They recently came in and took. Are we okay?
Yeah, go for it. They came and took.
Yeah, they came in and took over one of the local paper mills, and decided that it was more beneficial to close the mill and liquidate and put people out of jobs. And in an article in the recent Journal Sentinel, they stated that it's their intent to continue to close more mills down or shut the company down altogether.
Right. Yeah. These are dip and strip operations, and it probably wasn't a hedge fund. It was probably a private equity fund, the kind of thing that Mitt Romney ran. But it close enough. And John, it's a horrible example. This is not how. I'm even reluctant to use the word capitalism, but it's not how an economic system should run in a country like this. It's just it's a crying shame that there are these vulture funds out there that are just ripping this country apart. Thank you for sharing the story with us. That's so sad. Grant in Ventura, California. Hey, Grant, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I want to alert your listeners that on January 20th, tomorrow at noon from 7 p.m. we'll be occupying the federal courts in Santa Barbara at 1415 State Street.
Great. Okay. I will be occupying the United States Supreme Court tomorrow at noon.
So. Great. And, we here in Santa Barbara say we'll believe corporations are people when we see one curled up under a shopping cart in Mission Park.
Oh, wow. That's even more evocative than I'll believe a corporation is a person when Texas executes one. That's very well said. Thank you very much for the call, Grant, and good luck. Call us in and let us know how it went. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Tell us how it went.
Okay. Bye. I'll do it, yeah. And then next week we'll all fill each other in. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Hey, Sam, my old friend. How you doing?
Hey there, Tom.
How's the chemotherapy treating you?
I was wanting to say something about this Republican race thing.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to play a little game here with you. All right, who do you think is going to be the Republican candidate?
Romney.
All right, and you asked it back to me now.
Okay, who do you think is going to be the Republican candidate, Sam?
Nick Gingrich.
Really?
Nick Gingrich, yeah, because my dad said so. And
he's never been wrong? Huh.
He's never been wrong. He said as soon as he came out. And he's the one, 26 years Air Force and blah, blah, blah. And
yeah.
Remember, we've talked about it before.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see, Sam. We'll see. I'll bet you Mitt Romney's $10,000.
How about if I just send you $100?
No, no. You can bet me Mitt Romney's $10,000 too.
Either way.
Yeah. Either way, Mitt Romney's going to have to pay off the bet. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. I hope
$100 because I'm a supporter of Free Speech TV. I'm proud of it.
Yeah, there you go. And I hope your chemotherapy is doing well for you.
Go Progressives.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, good on you, Sam. Thanks a lot for the call, and apparently didn't want to get into that. Chuck in Novi, Michigan. Hey, Chuck, thanks for listening to WDTW. What's on your mind today?
A couple of things, Tom. Social Security, I had called in a few months ago, and we discussed that about how the limit, the ceiling used to be a lot lower, and back in the 70s, working in a factory, I was able to break the limit a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Getting this information out there to the younger people, most of them are not aware that there is a limit on there, which is what, like 106,000 now?
Right. And yeah, it's called the cap.
Most,
if you make more than that, you no longer pay Social Security tax. And so
most average working people aren't going to make anywhere near that.
That's right. The median income in the United States is in the high 40s, and the average income in the United States is in the $25,000 or $26,000 range. Individually.
Yep. So to me, a good way of solving a future shortfall is to just take off that ceiling. It shouldn't even exist.
That's what Bernie Sanders has been saying. That's what a lot of progressives, Jan Schakowsky and others, have been saying for a long time, is that that ceiling is crazy. You know, why should billionaires and millionaires and multimillionaires pay virtually nothing in terms of a percentage of their income for Social Security, whereas average working people have to pay Social Security taxes on every single penny that they earn? And if you lifted that cap, the Social Security system would be solvent and healthy and just happy as a clam forever. I mean, forever.
Yep.
I mean, long beyond the 70-year horizon. And, in fact, they could raise the benefits, you know, should do.
And another point, if I could make, I don't know if you're aware of one of the latest things the Republican and Snyder have done here in Michigan.
What's that?
With the Oakland County Commissioner District redrawing.
No, I didn't know about that. Oakland County is outside of Detroit.
Right. And the redistricting was required just like at the state level because of the census.
Right.
So it was it's done by certain officers, elected officials in the county. Well, this time it ended up being a Democratic majority, so the Republicans feared losing control. So they went to the state legislature and had them write a law specific to Oakland County only.
Oh, man. That's incredible. Chuck, thanks for the heads up on that. That's bad news, but thanks for letting us know. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly, and your calls live here from Health Action 2012. Yep, that music must mean it's time for the good, the bad, and the very, very ludicro-pathetically ugly, the good. Workers of Rolfs Patisserie. After the abrupt closing of Rolfs Patisserie in Chicago in early December, workers were given final paychecks only to have them bounce. Similarly, they were illegally denied 60 days notice or severance pay. After a legal battle and carefully organizing together, the workers of the patisserie have finally received some sort of money that they are owed under federal law from their previous employer. While this is a start, the workers are adamant about receiving the rest of what they're legally owed and are working closely with a workers' rights group to accomplish this goal. In today's political landscape, where unionization is under attack, the workers at Rolfs Patisserie show us the power of coming together to fight for what is right in the workplace. The bad. Arkansas Republican Representative Steve Womack. At a recent town hall meeting in his home state, Womack was asked by constituent Kelly Eubanks about his recent attacks on the Pell Grant program. Eubanks is a college student with two jobs and two kids and relies on Pell Grants to help pay for her education. But Womack thinks Pell Grants are a bad idea. He told Eubanks it wasn't the federal government's job to pay for her education and Eubanks should join the military to pay for her education like he had done. I guess Womack envisions a military made up of just the poor in America who can't afford to go to college. Who cares about educating kids as long as we have more tanks, missiles, and warships? That'll be just fine, right, Congressman Womack? And the very, very ugly Rush Limbaugh. On yesterday's show, Limbaugh argued that unlike President Obama, Mitt Romney has not, quote, lived like a king, end quote. He said, quote, Romney has not flown all over the world on the federal government's dime. Romney has not had lavish parties and concerts on the public dime. Romney has not lived like a king on other people's money, end quote. It seems Limbaugh's as confused as usual. Romney is the one who has made his wealth through corporate greed. Romney is the one who dodges taxes like they're the plague and takes advantage of loopholes in the federal government's on the federal government's dime. Romney is the one who believes $374,000 is chump change. President Obama grew up in a middle-class environment, has worked his way through his entire career without the aid of a rich daddy or corporate capital, unlike Mitt Romney, who was born a millionaire. Nice try, Limbaugh, but that's very, very ugly. And as I said, we are at the Health Action 2012 conference put on by Families USA here in Washington, D.C. at the Hyatt. And Kathy Bonk is with me. She is the executive director and co-founder of the Communications Consortium Media Center and co-author to the Guide to Strategic Communications for Nonprofits. The website is ccmc.org. And Kathy, welcome to the program. Oh, let me turn your microphone off. There we go. So,
thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And in the news, I have a couple of headlines here. I'd love to have you comment on them. Nearly half of U.S. households or of the U.S. live in households receiving government benefits. And Mercedes owners and PhD holders join crowd at soup kitchens. These are headlines. What's going on in America and why?
Boy, it's not great out there. I mean, I live part-time in Maine, which is one of the most rural and poorest states in the union. And fortunately, before our right-wing governor, Tea Party governor, took over, we were able to get through a piece of legislation that provided for a reasonably cost health care program that the state offers. And I know we've got a very close friend up there that didn't have coverage, had a stroke, was rushed to the hospital, but he was able to get under the care, health care program, and now he's headed to open heart surgery. So, you know, with things like the Affordable Care Act that just came into law, those folks that are really hurting, because let's face it, you lose your job these days, you lose your health care package.
Right.
And hopefully the new law is going to mean that if you lose your job, you still have health care, you still have education, you still have the basics to live by.
Yeah, and we need to go a whole lot farther than that.
Totally.
We really do. Yeah. So you're the executive director and co-founder of the Communications Consortium Media Center. You talk about how nonprofits should communicate.
I can.
A lot of really good stuff is being done by a lot of really great nonprofits in the United States. I'm on the board of a couple of them. And it seems like many, if not most of them, are totally incompetent at telling people the stories of the cool stuff that they're doing.
I know.
So do you have a five-point plan? Or
that's I do for a living.
Some quick rules about how to tell people about what you're up to?
Let me give you an example on healthcare right now. Even though we're ground zero for politics in the United States, what we've got to do is get the conversation away from the political frame of Obamacare, because it's being attacked every day. We've got to move it to a consumer frame so people, and especially women, understand what the new services mean for them and their family, the personal impact of the Affordable Care Act. And I've been fighting for women's rights and women's equality for almost 40 years. This is the single biggest advancement for women, probably since Title IX.
Why?
On sports. Because thank goodness for Senator Barbara Mikulski and the other women in the Senate, they put together a well woman's package that provides preventive services for women.
And this is part of Obamacare.
It will take effect August of this year, not 2014, this year. And what it means is there's no copay, no deductible for things like mammograms, cancer screenings, STD, AIDS tests. It means that if a woman is a victim of violence, she can get treatment under her plan. It's remarkable what it provides. And so we really want women to understand what it means for them, because when we are able to talk about the services, what we see is public opinion shifts dramatically from not supporting the bill to strongly supporting.
Well, it's just like when you ask people, do you like big government? They say no. And you say, do you like Social Security? Oh, of course.
Yeah, that's not government.
You know,
yeah, right.
Yeah,
don't
right.
take away my Medicaid. Medicare.
Yeah, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Right, those signs, exactly. that's why I think what we've got to be able to do in this next election cycle, I'm helping to put together a program called Her Votes. Mm-hmm. Her is health and economic rights. Mm-hmm. Usually what happens is, on women at least, the conversation just gets on abortion and doesn't get off of abortion. And there's a whole lot of issues out there that when women vote, they need to understand there are massive amounts of advancements that could be rolled back in this next election cycle. And so we're trying to prevent that from happening.
For example?
Well, voting. I mean,
the right of women to vote?
Well, in some of these states right now where they say you need a government ID, or you have to register under your legal name. Like, I don't have the same name as my husband. What's my legal name?
Right.
And if I'm an old, like my mother when she was 91, her passport was no longer invalid. They took away her driver's license. She didn't have a government ID with a picture on it.
Well, my mother, she had four boys within 6-7 years, and she just stopped driving and became a full-time mom.
Right.
And I don't think she had a driver's license from the time she was in her 30s.
Well, in some states today, if you don't have a government-issued photo ID, you may be denied to vote.
Right. So my mother, who was a poll worker,
that's right,
wouldn't have been able to vote.
And then this last congressional session, they defunded family planning and birth control.
Mm.
On the other hand, they funded birth control for horses, and they took it away for women.
Seriously?
Yes, seriously.
Who's this they?
This was the right-wing Republicans in Congress. They
this
had
is federal
bill.
Law.
Yeah. It never passed because it couldn't get through the Senate. But I did not think in my lifetime I would be debating birth control.
Yeah.
Basic birth control.
Well, I mean, it's like they're going back to the 1965. What
that's
was it,
right.
Cunningham versus Connecticut.
That's right.
It wasn't Cunningham.
Yeah,
somebody else.
Yeah.
Some name that reminds me of Richie Cunningham. Griswold.
Griswold
versus
right.
Connecticut.
That's right. That's right. Where women could legally get birth control over state lines.
Well, it wasn't just that. I mean, before
right.
the Supreme Court ruled that in Connecticut. You could be married, and the police could kick in the door
that's
to your
right.
bedroom, and if they found condoms in the
you could go to jail
next to your bed. Yeah,
that's right.
Right.
That's right.
That's incredible.
And so we're debating
and
that issue.
Want to bring
again.
That back?
That's right. We're debating that again. Santorum basically felt that the Griswold decision was wrong. It should be reversed. He said this about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the right
the
of
states.
Privacy. Yeah. Well, hello. That's something that women fought and won, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Same way with Title IX. There's all sorts of proposals to reverse equality in sports programs. Social Security, they're talking about major changes in Social Security. Well, women depend on Social Security more than men these days. So
because they live longer, too.
That's right. And so, you know, there's a whole package, and we've got to make sure women know what's at stake in this elections. But like you say, we can't be in the weeds. We have to be talking in more values, and that's why with the Affordable Care Act, things like prevention, choices, cost savings, there's a whole lot of good things in the Affordable Care Act for women and families that we got to shout the good news.
Right. Now, you keep referring to it as the Affordable Care Act. I'm fine calling it Obamacare because I think that he should get credit for it as people learn more about it.
Yeah, and also add an S to the end, Obamacare's, right?
Yeah, there you go. I mean, it's kind of a positive thing. I think when the Republicans tried to turn that into a negative, like the word liberal, you know.
Right.
I think they shot themselves in the foot. I think that's going to come back to haunt them.
There's actually a group out in Colorado that is trying to reframe Obamacare to a really positive thing.
Yeah,
so,
well,
yeah.
I'm part of them, I
Good.
Guess.
Or
I'm
Me
with
too.
Them, you
Me
know,
too.
In spirit.
It is going to be the single biggest thing that this president has done, because I don't think he's going to get much through Congress in the next few months. So we'll see.
Yeah, I agree.
Tom, you're terrific.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Kathy Bonk, thank you so much for being with us.
Great.
Really appreciate it. And appreciate the great work that you're doing. Thanks for being with
Likewise.
Us. We will be right back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Families USA Health Action 2012, the conference at the Hyatt in the Radio Row, surrounded by radio talk show hosts and all kinds of folks. And back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, Kathy, that's CCMC.org is your website. That's right. Okay, great. Thanks. We'll be right back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of decay, democracy is coming to the
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Health Action 2012 conference, Families USA, and I am pleased to have back on the show with us the guy who is kind of putting this thing all together, Ron Pollack, who is the executive director of Families USA. And, Ron, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, and welcome to
Whoa. Let me turn your microphone on here.
Well, that's great. Thank you for inviting me, and it's a delight to see you every time.
Well, thank you. Happy anniversary. Republicans voted to repeal health reform a year ago today. Do I have that right?
It was about right.
Yeah.
About right.
And so what's at stake with health care? I mean, this is Health Action 2012. What is Health Action? What
Well,
what's the big picture?
There are three priorities for 2012. This is actually the most significant year that I can remember, and I'm not a teenager. There are three things that are going to happen in 2012. Number one, state after state is figuring out how to implement the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And while we have a good, not perfect, but have a good statute, that doesn't mean that's the way it's going to be implemented. So a key challenge is to make sure that the state-by-state implementation is as vigorous and effective as possible. That's number one.
Right.
Number two, in 2 months, the Supreme Court is going to hear argument about the constitutionality of several provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And those are important provisions, including one of the key ways that health coverage is expanded for people who are uninsured. And the big kahuna, of course, is the November elections. That's going to determine whether we move forward with the Affordable Care Act, or the alternative is not only that we move backwards with respect to the Affordable Care Act being repealed, but Medicare and Medicaid will be in jeopardy, as we've seen from Republicans this year in terms of changes they would like to make with respect to those two key programs.
Yeah, I think it's important to, I don't think it can be repeated often enough, that every Republican, maybe there were a couple, two or three in the House of Representatives, but I thought it was every Republican, you would probably know, voted to end Medicare as we know it.
Yeah, it would transform the program to essentially a voucher program. And what does that mean? It means that the government would make a payment to help you with your premiums.
It's like you get food stamps for health.
Sort of, that's right. But with each passing year under this proposal, the portion of your premium costs that would be paid by the government would be less and less, and the amount that you had to pay as a senior wanting to participate in Medicare would be more and more. And so increasingly, seniors would be priced out of the affordability of Medicare.
Now, I see a headline in the news: Supreme Court holds the fate of Medicaid. What's this all? What's this is all about? What's going on with this?
Well, one of the challenges, which is extraordinary, is that some states have sued to declare unconstitutional the expansion of the Medicaid program.
Now, just for clarification, Medicare is what you get when you retire, and it's a health care system for elderly people, for people over 65. Medicaid is the program for poor people, and including children. In fact, in a lot of states, in Vermont, they call it Dr. Dinosaur. They administer it their own ways. So we're talking about Medicaid.
That's right.
Poor people program.
That's right. And what a lot of people don't know is that there are millions upon millions of people under anybody's standards, whether you're liberal or conservative, who are very, very poor, who are ineligible for Medicaid today. For example, let me take the states of Florida and Texas. They're the lead plaintiffs among the plaintiffs that have brought the suit. In Florida and in Texas, if you're an adult and you don't have any children, it makes no difference what your income is. You can literally, and I don't mean rhetorically, literally be penniless, and you're ineligible for Medicaid. And so what the Affordable Care Act does is it says that we're going to establish eligibility as a floor at 133% of the poverty level. So for a person living alone, it's about $14,000, $15,000. For a couple, it's a little over $20,000. And it says, irrespective of what state you're in, you will be eligible for Medicaid. And the states are challenging that. Now, what's extraordinary about this is that in the 46-year history of the Medicaid program, there have been many expansions of the program, and not one has been made successfully in the courts. And what's so incredible about this one is that in the first 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16, the federal government is paying 100% of the cost for those who are newly eligible.
So the states are saying, we don't want your money, and we're going to sue you not to give it to us?
No, what they're saying is, after 2016, we're going to have to pay some portion. It never goes above 10% of the cost.
Wow.
It goes from 100%.
Right. But they don't even want to pay that 10%.
They don't want to pay that 10%. But what's interesting is, you have to put that 10% in context, because the states are now paying out of their own money costs for the uninsured. In public hospitals, when people are getting free care, often the states are picking that up. And, of course, as you expand coverage for those people, the states are actually saving money. And the Congressional Budget Office tells us that the states, the net impact of the states is they're going to save money. So this is really ideological more than anything else.
Right. Purely, it seems.
And what the
state, we have a purely ideological five-vote majority on the Supreme Court right now.
Well, my hope is that at least one of them are going to see
maybe
that
Mr.
this is so unprecedented.
Mr. Kennedy,
that this is judicial activism at its worst. I mean, between Gore v. Bush and Citizens United, you know, which is now exploding in terms of PAC expenditures, this actually would take it means that any government program that establishes a condition for receipt of money is potentially unconstitutional.
Ron Pollack, the Executive Director of Families USA, familiesusa.org, the website. And thanks for this great conference and Radio Row you're putting on, sir.
It's always great to see you.
Up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.